This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. The longest single-series marathon in TV history is underway. All 552 episodes of The Simpsons are being shown back-to-back in sequential order over 12 days and nights on the FXX cable network. That's the lesser-known sibling of the FX cable network. It's a move clearly designed to get attention. And at least for us, it's done just that. So today, we're going to listen to some of the Simpsons-related interviews Terry has recorded over the years. We'll hear from Matt Groening, who created The Simpsons, as well as some of the actors who do voices on the show. But first, we'll hear from me, reviewing The Simpsons Marathon in my role here as a TV critic, a job I've held long enough to have reviewed The Simpsons back when it originally launched. There are two main things to consider here. First, there's the popularity and durability of The Simpsons. The animated Fox series begins its 26th season this fall and now holds the record as the longest-running scripted entertainment series in TV history. Then, there's the popularity of the TV marathon, which, despite the availability of most TV series on DVD or streaming services, is a programming stunt that continues to work. Cartoonist Matt Groening's yellow-skinned Simpsons family, Father Homer, Mother Marge, and the kids, Brainy Lisa, Bratty Bart, and Baby Maggie, began on TV as interstitial segments on Fox's The Tracy Ullman Show in 1987. They got their own Christmas special in 1989 and their own primetime series a month later to kick off 1990 in very sassy style. In other words, The Simpsons has been around a long time. So have I. Here's how I previewed that series on Fresh Air almost 25 years ago.
When it premieres as a regular series this weekend, The Simpsons will become the first primetime cartoon series since the 60s, the days of the Jetsons and Johnny Quest and the Flintstones. If The Simpsons is close in spirit to any of the shows from that era, though, it's to Rocky and Bullwinkle, which I loved as a kid. Who am I kidding? I love it now. And I love The Simpsons, too. It's just as funny, just as outlandish, and just as subversive.
Since then, The Simpsons has just about done it all. It sparked a renaissance in TV animation that led to South Park and Family Guy. One writer, Conan O'Brien, found fame as a talk show host. Celebrities providing guest voices on The Simpsons included most major movie stars, an uncredited Michael Jackson, and, on separate occasions, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr. Its Treehouse of Horror Halloween specials have become one of TV's most inventive annual traditions. And along the way, year after year, The Simpsons has served up occasional flashes of comic genius. There was the Season 4 episode that presents a Springfield Community Theater musical production of A Streetcar Named Desire. And the Season 2 episode that has Marge Simpson, voiced by Julie Kavner, so upset about the violence in the itchy and scratchy cat-and-mouse TV cartoons her kids watch that she goes on TV herself on a Nightline-type talk show in protest. Harry Shearer plays that show's host, and Marge quickly finds herself up against Itchy and Scratchy's producer, voiced by guest star Alex Rocco.
Smartline with our local Emmy Award-winning host, Kent Brockman.
Hello, I'm Kent Brockman, and welcome to another edition of Smartline. Are cartoons too violent for children? Most people would say no, of course not. What kind of stupid question is that? But one woman says yes. And she's here with us tonight, Mrs. Marge Simpson. Also with us for this animated discussion, Roger Myers, chairman of the board of Itchy and Scratchy International.
Thank you.
I think that it's a bad influence on children.
Give me a break. I think that is a bunch of baloney. And here's why. In preparing for this debate, I did a little research and I discovered a startling thing. There was violence in the past long before cartoons were invented.
I see. Fascinating.
Yeah, and there was something called the Crusades, for instance. Tremendous violence. Many people killed. The darn thing went on for 30 years.
And this was before cartoons were invented.
Oh, that's right, Kent. So much for your viewpoint.
There are those who say that the first years of The Simpsons are by far the best and the funniest. But if you've kept watching, you've seen such recent bits of brilliance as The Simpsons' trip to Israel in 2010 and this year's ambitious Lego episode, Brick Like Me. But why should you watch? Most previous episodes of The Simpsons are available on DVD, and reruns air all the time in syndication on local television. What makes a marathon, even a mega marathon like this one, such a big deal? I'm glad I asked. The popularity of TV marathons, whether they're annual two-day bursts of Twilight Zone episodes on Sci-Fi or complete run repeats of Breaking Bad or The Walking Dead on AMC, give viewers a chance to dive in at any time and feel a sense of community. That's something that's lacking when Netflix puts up an entire season of an original series for instant viewing. Having a TV series up in some internet cloud somewhere is like having a DVD set somewhere in my basement. Just because I can get to it doesn't mean I will. Yet on TV, whenever a marathon of an old show I love is on television, I'll invariably be sucked in, just as I am whenever some network shows Jaws for the zillionth time, or Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, or All the President's Men. It doesn't matter that I already own those movies, often in more pristine copies that are never interrupted or edited. There's something about the sense of watching at the same time as other people that makes it special. That certainly goes for a marathon. And that's why I predict this 25-season Simpsons marathon will indeed steer people towards FXX. It's a great show, a great idea, and a TV viewing event of unprecedented scale. And just think, in less than 2 weeks of uninterrupted viewing, you can see every variation on The Simpsons opening credits couch gag. Okay, now let's get to some of the interviews from the Fresh Air Archive. We'll start with a snippet of Terry's conversation with Julie Kavner, who does the voice of Marge Simpson. This was recorded in 1994.
So how do you change your voice to become Marge?
I roughen it up and I raise it a bit. I raise it an octave or so.
Can you do a little?
It's just kind of up there like that and a little more tired.
Right. Now, does it hurt your voice to do that?
Not at all. The sisters, on the other hand, the two twin sisters, are an octave lower. Do I have a range or what, Terry?
You want to do one of the sisters?
Well, they happen to be my favorites.
Oh, that's great. You have a wonderful voice. Was your voice husky when you were young?
Yeah, I was born this way. I came out of my mom and said, "Hello, Rose. Hello, Dave."
But did you have a deep voice when you were young?
Yeah, they used to send me home. They always used to think I had laryngitis.
Oh, the nurses? Or...
Mm-hmm.
You have a very New York voice, but you grew up in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Well, Rose and Dave, who I just mentioned to you, my
parents,
they're from New York, and they taught me how to speak English. You see, so that's why I sound like this, as opposed to something lovely.
Julie Kavner speaking to Terry Gross in 1994. Hank Azaria voices several characters on The Simpsons, including Mo, the bartender, Police Chief Wiggum, and Apu, the owner of the Quickie Mart. Terry spoke with Hank Azaria in 2004.
How did you get to be on The Simpsons? And two of the voices you do are Mo, the bartender, and Apu, who runs the convenience store, the Quickie Mart.
Yes, that's correct. Mo was the first voice I did. There's little Mo for you there. And Apu was actually the third voice, I believe, that I did. And I was 22 years old. This was a long time ago. I'm 40 now. I was 22 years old, and I hadn't worked much. There was an original voice of Mo, the bartender, that I guess they weren't too happy with. Wanted to replace. And I did this voice, and I was doing the play at the time in L.A. where I was playing a drug dealer, and I was sort of doing a bad Al Pacino impression in the play from Dog Day Afternoon. I was sort of talking like this, like kind of Al kind of sounded in Dog Day Afternoon. And I said, "What about that voice?" They're like, "Well, we want Mo to be gravelly." So I just made that voice gravelly, and it sounded like that. The next week I did Wiggum. Chief Wiggum, chief of police, talks like this. And then I did Apu. And then after about midway through the second season, they made me they gave me a contract. They made me a regular. By that point, I was doing like 5 or 10 voices.
Do you have a favorite Mo scene?
Favorite Mo scene? There's been a lot. He's one of my favorite characters. You know, one of my favorite times is when Mo is asking a girl out. And he says to her that he's going to go out and buy her a steak the size of a toilet seat. That one sort of stayed with me.
You've had to sing as Apu?
I have had to sing as Apu, it's true.
Is it hard to sing in character?
It's much easier for me to sing in character. It's much more difficult for me to sing in my own voice. It's much easier for me to sing as Wiggum or as Apu or even as Mo.
Why is that?
I think I'm just more comfortable with you know, the mask, you know, and the vocal mask. You know, Chief Wiggum's like this. It's sort of easier to sing like this than it is to sing. I'm not embarrassed to do that, but I'd be embarrassed to do the same thing in my own singing voice. It's weird.
Hank Azaria, recorded in 2004. The voice of Bart Simpson is performed by Nancy Cartwright. She's aged over 25 years since she started doing Bart, but Bart remains a child, and Cartwright remains convincing. Cartwright also does the voices for several other Simpsons characters, including Nelson Muntz, Ralph Wiggum, and Todd Flanders. When Terry spoke with Cartwright in 2007, Cartwright told her about auditioning for The Simpsons.
So I went in and shook Matt Groening's hand, and I said, you know, I'm here to read for Lisa, but I saw the part for Bart, and I'd rather read for him. Do you mind? And he said, no, it's fine. So I gave him one shot, one take, one sound, one voice, and that was it. Blah, 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 blah. And Matt, his eyebrows went up, his tongue came out of his mouth. He's like, oh, my God, that's him, that's Bart, that's him. You got the part. And I was given the part on the spot.
So is it... There's nothing conscious going on when you do the voice. It just came to you.
Yeah. It just, no kidding. When I saw the picture, it really helps when you get the visual image of what the character looks like. Because sometimes you might have a character whose jaw is sticking out a little bit more on the bottom than it is on the top. And he's got this sort of, there's a placement there. So you know that his lower teeth would be sticking out a little bit farther. So that would help in creating a character. Or say you've got a 7-year-old kid who's got a split in his two front teeth. Or he's missing one of his teeth at age 7.
So he would be talking sort of like this, and you can put a sort of a sound in there, sort of like that little actress that played on Mrs. Doubtfire.
So I can steal from, you know, Mara Wilson, I think was that little actress's name, and I totally ripped that off from her.
Well, why don't you describe who Nelson is and how you came up with his voice?
Well, Nelson, he was a bad boy, and I had to read the script because there's not much of a description in the script. It might say bad boy, but it didn't go into detail on it. So by reading the script and, you know, putting that in context, I realized he was just this, he was a thug. He was bigger physically than Bart. So he was also, I believe Nelson Muntz is a little bit older, even though he's in the fourth grade. But I just ended up coming up with the sound that I think Nelson has sort of evolved, and it came to the point where he eventually got a really, really rough sound like that. And he has got a really, really hard R's. And I don't know, that's how that sound came. And the laugh, the ha-ha, let me just say it for ha-ha, that was written in the script as it just said, I think it actually just said ha-ha. And I don't know. If somebody else would have been cast as that, they would have come up with their own idea of what that would sound like. But when I did that, it got an instant laugh, and so that stuck. And because I think it got that laugh, the writers put a little asterisk or a little star beside that, and they know that later on they can do that again, and hopefully it'll continue to get a laugh. And it's through trial and error and through experimenting. I don't think anybody said, let's create a signature laugh for Nelson Muntz. Do you know what I mean? It's just something that sort of evolved. And I find that fascinating, too, in looking at the development of The Simpsons, that a lot of choices that we had the opportunity to make, they were just opportunities that we had. Nobody was going out there and saying, wow, when I do this, this is going to become a catchphrase. Next thing you know, this is, smell you later, that people are going to be saying that, you know?
When you do that gruff, like, Nelson voice, does that hurt your vocal cords at all? Like, is there a way of doing that without it hurting?
You know, he truly is he's the most challenging in terms of my vocal cords, but throughout the years and the 400-plus episodes that we've done so far, Nelson has only really been a lead character or citizen in just maybe a couple or three. One of my favorite ones was when it was that tribute when he came home and Marge really kind of took him under his wing and he sang that song. It was a tribute to, it was a play on Yentl. I don't know if I can do it. Papa, can you hear me? He's singing to his father because his father left to go get cigarettes or milk or something at the Quickie Mart. He never came. Papa, is that you? Is that you? Oh, Papa.
What's it like when you're doing both sides of the conversation? Say, like Bart's talking to Nelson.
Yeah, that's fun. That's really, really fun. There was one show, I think it was a take on I think it was called Bart's Commandments, or it was some Ten Commandments show. It was a play on, took you back in time, and there was a scene where it was Bart, Nelson, Ralph, and Kearney, I believe, and oh my God, the scene was like 3 pages long, and I was just talking to myself the entire time, and I remember doing it at the table read. I was so nervous to do it in front of that. Oh, there's like 100 people in the room, and I'm doing it just praying that I wouldn't get confused who I was. And I finished my run, and I was sweating. I was like really perspiring, and I was out of breath. There's no time to even breathe practically. That is such a challenge. And yet, but if it's just like one scene, there was one scene where Bart had a Mr. Microphone and he was in the bottom of the well pretending like he was somebody else, and Rod and Todd Flanders were next door and they were picking him up on their radio, and Bart's like, "Rod, Todd, this is God." He goes, "What are you doing on our radio?" "What do you mean, what am I doing on the radio? I created the universe, stupid kid." "What do you want from us?" I want you to go to the kitchen and bring forth all the cookies from your kitchen." "But those are our parents' cookies." "What do you want, a God, well, happy God or a vengeful God?" "Happy God, happy God." "Then bring forth the cookies." "Yes, sir." It's a challenge, but it's fun.
Nancy Cartwright, recorded in 2007. We'll continue our tribute to The Simpsons by listening to interviews with the show's creator, Matt Groening, after a quick break. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. The FXX cable network is currently showing all 552 episodes of The Simpsons back-to-back over the course of 12 days. The marathon has inspired us to listen back to some of The Simpsons-related interviews Terry has recorded over the years. Up next, we're going to hear excerpts from a couple of interviews Terry recorded with Matt Groening, who created The Simpsons as a series of animated shorts for Tracy Ullman's TV variety show. Terry first spoke with Matt Groening in December 1989, just before the premiere of The Simpsons Christmas special that launched the show as a weekly primetime series. Terry asked Groening then if he would describe The Simpsons as an animated sitcom.
They're more like a hallucination of a sitcom, for me. Anyway, I'm so used to drawing my cartoons and not having them move that when I see these characters actually come to life and strangle each other and shout and yell and laugh and scream, it's like hallucinating, at least for me, and I hope that experience will be the same for the rest of America.
Did you have to draw, I don't know if it's called a Bible or not, but did you have to draw what each of your characters look like from different angles and in motion so that the animators would know how the characters look?
Yes. Mike's stuff is basically... I see it two-dimensionally. It's very flat, and I draw my characters almost always from a three-quarter profile. And the animators had to come up with ways of showing them from straight on and from behind. Those are angles that I rarely, if ever, use in my own work. But even tougher than that was we created a 8-inch-high Bart head in clay for the Bart Simpson talking doll, which is due in your local toy stores if the show is a hit. And I'm really proud of this doll because he gets to say a number of outrageous things. The only thing the toy company wouldn't let me have him say is, "I'm Bart Simpson, who the hell are you?" They felt that was too much to come out of a kid's toy. They also wouldn't let him burp, which I was very disappointed by. But
so what,
maybe
what,
that in the next time.
What does he say?
My favorite thing is, kids in TV land, you're being duped. I had a lot of flack over that because they said kids aren't going to know what the word duped means. So I offered the substitute brainwashed, but they didn't go for that.
Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons, recorded in 1989. Terry spoke with Groening again in 2003 when The Simpsons was just about to broadcast its 300th episode. She began that interview with this clip of The Simpsons around the dinner table with their guest, Krusty the Clown.
Who wants to say grace?
Why don't we let our guests do it?
Krusty, would you do the honors?
Well, all right, I'm a little rusty, but I'll try. Baruch ata Adonai, Eloheinu melech haolam, hamotzi lechem, min haaretz.
Oh, he's talking funny talk.
No, Dad, that's Hebrew. Krusty must be Jewish.
A Jewish entertainer? Get out of here.
Dad, there are many prominent Jewish entertainers, including Lauren Bacall, Don Shore, William Shatner, and Mel Brooks.
Mel Brooks is Jewish?
I want to ask you about some of the characters that didn't exist in the very beginning stages of The Simpsons, starting with Krusty the Clown, who's this really funny character. I mean, he's basically like an old vaudevillian type. He's kind of really bitter and Jewish, like a lot of comics, and but this is like an old style Jewish comic dash clown. What did you think of Krusty when he was first created?
Well, Krusty was based on a TV show clown who I grew up with in Portland, Oregon, named Rusty Nails. Rusty Nails was a Christian clown. He was he had his own show, and he showed old Three Stooges shorts. And he was great, and he wasn't like Krusty at all. He was very nice guy, and a very sweet clown. But he had that name, Rusty Nails, which I found incredibly disturbing as a child. Because, you're supposed to avoid Rusty Nails. So... So the idea of a clown named Rusty Nails.
You were a sensitive little kid.
Clowns are scary to begin with. And even though this was a nice clown, I was slightly perturbed by him.
You know, we spoke just as The Simpsons was coming into existence, starting first as a Tracy Ullman series. And I think we spoke just as it was about to be broadcast on its own. And a lot has happened since then. Simpsons have taken over the world since then. I'm wondering how your vision of the characters as they are now compare with the vision you had when you were creating them.
Well, here's the problem with doing a sitcom which has lasted more than 300 episodes is you're trying not to repeat yourself. You're trying to surprise the audience, and you're trying to keep... everybody works on the show surprised. As a result, the show has gone off in some very peculiar directions. Sometimes I was alarmed. I was going, oh, my God, we can't do this. We can't do this. And then it turns out to be okay. One of the great things we did last year was we parodied the Fox News Channel. And we did the crawl along the bottom of the screen. Uh-huh. And Fox fought against it and said that they would sue. They would sue the show. And we called their bluff because we didn't think Rupert Murdoch would pay for Fox to sue itself. So we got away with it. But now Fox has a new rule that we can't do those little fake news crawls on the bottom of the screen in a cartoon because it might confuse the viewers into thinking it's real news.
Let's talk about Itchy and Scratchy. And this is the recurring cartoon that Bart and Lisa watch on TV. And it's the kind of like super violent version of all the cat and mouse kind of cartoons. How'd you come up with this?
Well, it was from watching cat and mouse cartoons growing up. Pixie and Dixie, the Hanna-Barbera mice, and Tom and Jerry in particular. Very, very violent and very, very funny cartoons, MGM cartoons. And the fantasy was wanting these cartoons to extend their violence even more. So with Itchy and Scratchy, it's as extreme as it can get for a cat and mouse cartoon. We've done so many of them that they're harder and harder to write. And originally, of the actors, Harry Shearer, who's a sophisticated guy, he seemed to laugh the hardest at Itchy and Scratchy during the table reads. I think I don't know if he's the voice of Itchy or Scratchy, but he's the voice of one of them. He talks like that. Dan Castellaneta is the voice of the other one.
So were you in on the writing of the Itchy and Scratchy theme song?
Yeah, well, yeah, that was obvious. It's by the way, it's not, everybody thinks it's, they fight and fight and fight and fight and fight. It's not. It's they fight and bite and fight and fight and bite.
Well, I think it's time to hear the Itchy and Scratchy theme song. Let's hear it.
The lyrics to that were written by Sam Simon, one of the original producers who developed the show, along with Jim Brooks, and basically set the tone for the show.
Matt Groening is the creator of The Simpsons. That interview was recorded in 2003. In 2008, Fresh Air played a small part in an episode of The Simpsons. But why don't I let Terry tell you about that?
You know how the series often features actors and how celebrities often play themselves? Well, sometimes the writers aim lower, which is how I got a bit part in the episode The Departed, which is a parody of Scorsese's film The Departed. In this scene, Homer has just rented a car, and he's driving with Lisa.
This car is amazing. The radio lets me contribute directly to NPR.
This is Terry Gross from NPR saying thank you. Now let's get back to our 1987 interview with Senator Alan Cranston.
I never dreamed an American car designed in Germany, assembled in Mexico from parts made in Canada, could be so amazing.
Yeah, I can't believe all those years I used to drive that old piece of...
What the...
Recording that scene was really fun. I was alone in the Fresh Air studio. My director was listening to me from L.A. He gave me what I think is the most amusing professional advice I've ever gotten, which is, sound more like a cartoon version of yourself.
All 552 episodes of The Simpsons are being shown back-to-back in sequential order over 12 days and nights on the FXX cable network. The marathon wraps up on September 1st. We'll close our tribute to The Simpsons with a musical number from one of my favorite episodes of the show. It's the episode A Streetcar Named Marge from Season 4, in which Marge is cast as Blanche DuBois in a musical production of A Streetcar Named Desire.
My name is Blanche DuBois. A never-ending party. Ha! I'm a faded southern dame without a dime.
I'm collecting for the Evening Star.
Come here. I want to kiss you just once, softly and sweetly on your mouth.
I am just a simple paper boy. No romance do I seek. I just wanted for decency for my deliveries last week. Will this bewitching floozy seduce this humble newsy? Oh, what's a paper boy?
Depended on the kindness of strangers.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with author Stephen A. Rick Clark. His first novel, called Sweetness Number 9, has just been published. It's about a flavor chemist who starts his career in 1973 at a flavor company whose new product is an artificial sweetener called Sweetness Number 9. The flavor chemist is responsible for testing the product on lab rats and monkeys and monitoring their health effects. He reports a lot of side effects that are covered up by the company. Sweetness Number 9 soon becomes the artificial sweetener used in diet drinks and many other foods, and also is marketed in little packets for use in coffee and tea. When the flavor chemist sees Americans overcome by the symptoms he found in the lab animals, like obesity, rage, depression, he feels personally responsible for not having blown the whistle on the manufacturer. The novel takes a satirical look at over two decades of food wars, family life, and American culture.
Stephen Eric Clark, welcome to Fresh Air. So let's start with a reading from Sweetness Number 9. And this is toward the beginning when he becomes, when your main character becomes a flavorist in training at a flavor laboratory. And he's told he'll be working on testing a new artificial sweetener, testing that on rats and monkeys. So he sees himself as a flavor artist and not so much as a tester, but he's happy to be at this flavor house. So how about the reading?
And how couldn't I be so thrilled? It was a wonderful time to embark upon a career in the flavor sciences, a golden age, I can't help but think now. Just consider, in the 19th century, the industry existed solely for the benefit of the baker, confectioner, and soda maker. But following the end of the Second World War, the profession experienced a great westward expansion as a result of the TV dinner, a Louisiana purchase that was drawn in the shape of a four-compartment aluminum tray. This was added to in short time by the launch of the first domestic microwave, a Sputnik-like event that caused young men, such as myself, to heed the call of the nation's top food science programs. I was now on the other side of my Master of Science degree and being asked to start in animal testing, but this was in no way unexpected. Animal testing at Goldstein, Olivetti & Dark was like the mailroom at the old William Morris Talent Agency. Even those recruited out of the Ivy League started here.
So this is obviously like a calling for him in the golden age of the flavoring industry. Why did you choose the flavoring industry as the setting for the novel?
Well, I'd lived my whole life eating these flavorings, and I'd never really stopped to consider the importance of them until reading Fast Food Nation in 2001. Flavorings were like gravity or electricity, something that was all around me but that I'd never paid any attention to. And as soon as I read that book and its chapter on food product design, I started to ask myself, you know, how important are these to the foods? And I started to question if I was really eating food or just the idea of food. Because with these molecules, you know, you can make something taste like grass or roasted chicken. And what is it covering up? What is it supporting? What is it enhancing? All these questions and philosophical ideas that sprang out of the simple industry just went off, and I found myself deep into a novel.
Was the 70s a golden age for this, like you say in the novel?
I think so. It wasn't really until the last 10 years that we started to talk about food and what goes in it. And in 1998, when the novel starts, organic didn't have a definition, and farmers' markets hadn't taken off. In the novel, I talk about there being sort of a great awakening in the nation's food consciousness to sort of rival the religious awakenings that we have in our country every now and then. And it seems like in the late 90s, this is what was happening, and it's continuing to happen today. So in the 70s, when Tang was still king, we were just eating, and we weren't really questioning.
And for anybody who doesn't remember, Tang was a powdered orange drink that was artificially flavored and sweetened. Is that a fair description?
That went to space, I think.
That went into
too.
Space, exactly. Or at least that's what we were told.
Right.
This was made for the astronauts. So you've also made your main character someone who in the 1970s saw himself as part of the silent majority, or Spiro Agnew described silent majority, that was very conservative. He was afraid the communists were going to take over if we weren't vigilant. He supported the war in Vietnam. He remained a virgin into grad school. Why did you make him a conservative member of the silent majority?
Well, I read a lot of books about heroes, or, you know, people who are very right-minded, and I didn't want to write a book that was going to be looking at what is right with food, where somebody was righteously talking about this is what food should be. And I wanted somebody who, like most of us, puts his faith in the American food system and slowly begins to question it. He's in the middle of the industry. He's making these flavorings, and he hasn't paid much attention to it until things start to happen to his family and his wife and his child. And he has to start to question, what am I doing and what are we eating? If he was somebody who was more heroic, who knew the answers from the start, he wouldn't have had any change to go through. And I don't think that I would have wanted to sit through a book listening to him sort of tell me what I should know. I'm more interested in people who are full of contradictions and questions and have to struggle to arrive at something.
Sweetness number 9, the artificial sweetener that he has to test on lab rats and monkeys at the beginning of the book, it's life-changing for him because he sees the side effects that it's causing in these lab animals. What was the place of sweeteners in the 70s when this part of the book takes place? We had saccharin. Did we have sweet and low yet?
No, this is taking place at a time when we only had saccharin, and the FDA had started to question it in the early 60s. There had been some studies linking it to cancer in lab rats, and the only reason it wasn't taken off the market was that it was the only thing on the market, which sounds kind of crazy, but a number of industries were trying to outdo that and create a new substitute sweetener that could then take over the marketplace. And this is what the book's about. It's about one of these companies with Sweetness number 9 being the second into the market.
And in terms of the testing, nothing seems to matter except do the lab rats get cancer? And they don't get cancer, but they do get obese and angry, like mood disorders. So all kinds of bad things are happening to them. Do you think that that's the way it was then or still is now, that the issue is cancer or not, that that's what's being measured and only that?
Yeah. When I started researching this subject, I went to a flavor lab in California where I was living at the time, and I spoke to the chief flavorist there, and I said, you know, there's a rise in autism, ADHD, attention deficit disorder, all of these other things, depression, anxiety. What's going on in American culture? Is it possible that the food that we're eating could be causing this? I wanted that question answered. And he said, well, you know, we don't test for any of that. I'm not sure we could test for that. And it would certainly be very expensive if we did. We primarily look for cancer. That's what the FDA asks. There are rules saying that if anything causes cancer in man or animal, it can't be entered into the food stream. So that's the focus of all of these clinical studies.
So your main character, when he realizes all the problems that Sweetness number 9 is having in the lab animals, he protests within the company, but he doesn't become a whistleblower outside for reasons I'll let readers discover on their own. But he starts feeling guilty for everything, for his wife's obesity, for obesity in America, for his son's unusual language disorder, for his daughter's obsession with organic food, for his own early problems with fertility. And I have to read the sentence about this. It's a great sentence. He writes, his sperm was described as sluggish and listless, everything but alcoholic and unemployed. Anyways, great sentence. So did you go through a period writing this as a father, when you were just worried that every problem that your child had was something that you had caused?
Well, I don't know about the causing the problems, but you do think more about what you're feeding your family whenever you are a father. It's one thing to eat microwavable dinners as I did as a single man, but whenever I've got two young boys, you stop and question, what am I putting into their bloodstreams? What's going into their brains? And does this have any influence on them? And so we're left with these questions, you know, why is this happening? Or why do they act this way or feel this way? And you want to know an answer. So a lot of people look to food, and we have to ask ourselves, you know, does it have anything to do with it? I don't know that we can provide an answer, but we have that question, and then that anxiety is really at the center of the book.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Eric Clark. He's the author of the new novel, Sweetness Number 9, and you may have heard it got the Colbert Bump And it's about a flavorist, somebody who designs artificial flavors for food. And it spans from 1972 to the late 1990s. Let's talk about vanilla. One of the companies that your flavorist works for in the novel has a flavor that's called No-Nilla, and they're working on improving it. And we're told in the novel that there's only enough vanilla beans in this world to satisfy a country the size of Germany. And here we are in the vanilla-dependent U.S., where less than 2% of the world's beans are grown, but more than 3 out of every 4 are consumed. Is that true? I didn't know that.
I saw that in my research somewhere along the way. I read a lot of back issues of food product design and the newsletters for the Society of Flavor Chemists, and I picked up that tidbit of information somewhere along the way. So yeah, I think it is true. And it's one of the things to show that there is a valid, you know, reason to use these additives, these flavorings in our food, because otherwise, yeah, maybe only the rich or the privileged would then be able to have vanilla flavorings in their food. So it's not an anti-flavorings novel. It does, I hope, look at it in a way that includes the complications and the contradictions and the good and the bad. And this is one of them, you know, the ability to have vanilla flavorings in so many different food products. We might not have that if we were relying only on the natural vanilla bean.
You know, it's funny. I happen to love the taste of vanilla, but people are always comparing it negatively to chocolate. And the word vanilla has become a pejorative, like, oh, you're so vanilla, or that's so vanilla, meaning bland and unadventurous.
And American.
Oh, and American? Yeah?
Yeah, I think vanilla is a very American flavor. That's one of the reasons I chose it as the center of, or the specialty for this company. The chief flavorist, the starter, the person who started the company is a German who comes here, and his attempts to, you know, please the market is by creating this really great vanilla. And it's also the reason the global vanilla crisis of 1963 is sort of behind this creation of No-Nilla. He knows that America needs vanilla, and so he's going to find the thing that allows you to use that flavoring. Even when you only have half of the flavoring in any product, it amplifies that flavoring.
About once a week, your main character, the flavorist, likes to sit down with a food and analyze the flavoring, every note, every tone in the flavor. And he does that with a manwich. So to get a sense of how he approaches taste, I'd like you to read that passage from Sweetness Number 9.
Sold as the manwich, this heat-and-serve meal weighed in at a hearty 790 calories. It was comprised of one sausage patty, 2 eggs, a couple of slices of bacon, and a roof of American cheese as orange as a road cone. I was not eating it out of idle curiosity or owing to an extravagant appetite. It was my routine on Mondays to sit down to a long working breakfast. So in addition to my knife and fork, I had a legal pad and a pencil beside my plate, along with plans to break down and identify all the components of the flavors I could detect in the manwich. My meal's failures were apparent to me from the first bite. The bacon needed to be microwaved separately for optimum crispness. The eggs had been misquoted, if you will, and the savory flavorings used to prop up the processed meats and cheese were no more memorable than the propylene glycol that carried them.
Did you start approaching food this way too, so you'd know what to write for your character? Like analyzing every taste?
I did, but this is also something I picked up from my research. I visited a flavor creation lab in New Jersey, and this is one of the things that the flavorist did. He said that, you know, it was very difficult for his wife to enjoy dinner out because he'd always be jotting down the components of the flavoring on a napkin or the placemat. And so this is one of the things that I used to make this character more authentic.
Sweetness Number 9 is footnoted, and your main character, the flavorist, says in one of the footnotes, referring to himself, "You can always count on a flavorist for a fancy prose style." And that's a paraphrase of a very famous line from Vladimir Nabokov's novel Lolita, in which he says, "You can always count on a murderer for a fancy prose style." Why did you want to give that line a shout in your novel?
Well, there are a lot of shouts in the novel, and that's one of them. Nabokov is perhaps my favorite writer, Lolita, perhaps my favorite novel. It, too, is a memoir told by somebody who is looking back on what he's done. And David later on does question whether or not he is a murderer, if not a literal one, then a metaphorical one. He's been responsible for helping launch this sweetener into the American food system. And he doesn't know if it has caused untold number of problems, perhaps causing anxiety, apathy, obesity, perhaps causing some things that have led to premature deaths. So he feels a little bit like a murderer, and I think that's a literary way to sort of first allude to that early in the novel. But also, at the same time, a flavorist is somebody who is very much interested in artistry. And so he wouldn't have a plain, unadorned prose style. Another flavorist is described as being able to create great fugues of flavor. It's a very creative field with, you know, all of these notes, like a musician would have notes, you know, a little bit of vanilla, a little bit of butterscotch, put a little dark chocolate note in there. And the arrangements of these flavors is what creates, you know, the subtleties of something that's good rather than just something that is a bald and unappetizing flavor.
So you wrote Sweetness Number 9, your new novel, over the course of about 12 years. Did you ever think, wow, I'm still writing this novel, it's been 8 years, it's 9 years, it's 10 years, I'm never going to finish it?
Yeah. You know, whenever you start a book and you think about books that take 12 or 13 years, you think, oh, God, that's probably, you know, a work of genius. Somebody spends that long, but you have a completely different relationship to the idea. By the time you get to 6 years, you go, oh, that's not a work of genius. That's a work of madness. You know, who would spend this long working on something like that? And so by about year six or seven, you know, writers I knew would be saying, oh, you're still working on that, are you? And you start to really doubt yourself and wonder what you're doing, and is it going to be any good, and will you ever sell it? And it's nothing that I would recommend. I hear a lot of people at readings, you know, say, well, what is your writing process? And I would say, you don't want to listen to mine. I mean, I took 13 years to write this book. And so those first couple of years, I wasn't even thinking about trying to finish a book. I was just hanging out with my characters, eavesdropping on them, and had no idea about where the story was going. And it was only after about the third or fourth year that I started to see a story develop. This Sweetness Number 9 became more and more important, and I said, okay, now let's get to it.
Stephen Eric Clark is the author of the new novel Sweetness Number 9. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bensel. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.